The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 4, already more than halfway through this session of this November 2014 session at Mountain Gate. And it's all white out there. Another snow, which is very good for the flora, all our greenery, such as it is. But it's going to be a little bit of a challenge for Patrick to do the plumbing fill-in tomorrow, if he does decide to do that. It's wonderful to have the moisture. We'll see what happens with the construction. Today I'd like to continue sharing with you some of the teachings of the Korean Son Master Kusan Sunim. Sunim is a title. I'm not exactly sure what exactly it means, but it is a title. And his teachings in a number of retreats were translated into English and published under the title of The Way of Korean Zen. And today, as it turns out, we're slightly more than midway past midway through our 7-day session, and we're going to take up Kusan Sunim as he is giving a talk midway through their extended practice period. Traditionally, in Asia, in Buddhist temples, there were practice periods of various lengths, 100 days, 90 days, and so on and so forth. At Sogenji, the practice period, there are two practice periods in the year, and one of them goes from February into August, and the other goes from August into February. So there's not a single moment, essentially, at Sogenji where they're not in a practice period, an intensive practice period. And when one practices like that in an ongoing manner, it can make a huge difference in one's life. I value deeply all the time I spent at Sogenji, the years I lived there, and the many, many, many months each year that I went back to continue that intensive training. Life is short. How much time do we have? And even though I had done 19 years of intensive training at the Rochester Zen Center, much of it in residence under Kapler Roshi, I was with him twice on an extended periods of several months in Mexico, and was his attendant when he lived in Santa Fe at a couple of different times. And even when I was living in Santa Fe, after the Rochester Zen Center gave up on trying to build a country center somewhere near Santa Fe, I still went back to Rochester for big chunks of time, 3 months at a time, 6 months once, to continue my intensive training. And after 19 years of that, I still didn't feel that I had reached the depth of practice that I could reach, even though Rochester is a very intensive training experience, particularly on the spectrum of training experiences in the United States. And so I chose to go to Sogenji in Japan and continue my training there. I remained there for 3 years, and then, as I said, went back for several months each year, several weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks each year, until 2 years ago, to continue that intensive training. And each time I would go back, I would be able to do 2 ozishin some kozishin, all of which are very, very intensive periods of practice. And I still practice. And I still practice with a teacher. And I think that is very, very important. As long as Harada Roshi is alive, I can't imagine not going to Sesshin with him as long as he's able to give Sesshin. This mind is so vast and so filled over so many lifetimes with habit patterns, assumptions, conditioning, that it's not going to be cleared out in a few years, in a few months, even I think in a few lifetimes. When you take a look at the Jataka tales of Buddhist history, these are the lives that the man known as the Buddha, the Awakened One, recalled during his profound zazen in what became the first official sesshin of Buddhism, when he came to his deep awakening. And in each of these previous lives, he is working on himself. He is deepening his awareness and becoming more let go. This is an incredible practice we can do. And although there are times, particularly in the earlier years, where it can seem impossibly daunting, impossibly difficult, if we stick it out, it will make an enormous difference. And not just in our own lives, but in the lives of those around us and the lives of those unseen by us. People whom we would never even perhaps be encountering in this life. Still, when a person is reasonably sensitive, they can pick up on the clarity of mind of people far and wide. It makes a difference. And the TEM folks were very big into scientific inquiry in terms of substantiating the value of their transcendental meditation. And I did a lot of studies, and at least one study was done where they had a large body of people meditating at a particular time over an extended period of time, a month or something like that. I don't recall the exact details of this particular study, but they correlated it with a reduced incidence of crime in that area. And it was apparently significant statistically. Of course, it's hard to say that the zazen or the meditation caused that, but there's a very good chance that it influenced it. As I said, when one person's mind is clear, it resonates throughout the whole universe, because even though it appears that we're all separate individuals, in reality there are no boundaries. So this is Kusansunim speaking on the occasion of the midpoint of a 90-day retreat. And first he recites a poem. Casting a fishing line of 1,000 feet into the ocean of space, the clouds disperse, the waves settle, and the coral grows. The fish and the dragons sleep deeply and do not move. Load the ship full with the moon, pull the oar and depart. There is the story of an ancient master living a hermit's life up in the mountains in China, and a robber came and cleaned him out of what little he actually had, which was basically almost nothing. And when the master returned and discovered the loss, he sighed and said, "I wish I could have given him the moon." Apparently there was a full moon that night, and if anybody has walked breathless down the hallway here on the night of full moon was rising and caught a glimpse of it through the door at the end of the hallway, it is breathtaking. That could also have been a metaphor for awakening. A Assembly of monks, it is true that these days you're exerting much effort in your practice of meditation. And I would agree with that in terms of those of you here in Sesshin. However, I would like to add a few words for your benefit. Of the 90 days of this winter retreat, already half have passed. For today, we've reached the midpoint of the meditation season, and only 45 days are now left. Every day, time flows urgently on like water. Even though it may seem that there are certain enjoyments in daily life, actually, we're just like fish in a pool whose water is constantly being drained away. When all the water has gone, the fish will surely die, won't they? Likewise, not only you monks gathered here, but all sentient beings are traveling the path that only leads to death. It sounds a little bit grim, but the other side of it is, there's a poem that goes with one of the koans in the Mumong Khan, and it reads like this. When the light of your eyes is falling, in other words, when you're dying, how will it be for you then? Will you be like the crab with its seven arms and eight legs struggling to get out of the boiling water? Most of us, not all of us, but most of us, particularly when we're younger, don't think too much about death unless something has happened near us where somebody has died, and then it's smack in our face. But even then, we may not connect it with our own mortality. I remember when I was in my very early 20s and we had been posted to Rangoon, Burma, Yangon, Myanmar, and we lived in the embassy compound, which doesn't exist anymore because they tore down the cottages and built a new and more secure embassy there. The old embassy was downtown. And it was on the edge of a lake. And we were on a high bluff above the lake, and there were steps down to right along the shore where there was a tennis court. And on Sunday mornings, we would go, and my husband and I would play tennis, and the kids were quite young. Randy was 2.5. Greg was, well, he learned how to stand up and walk in Rangoon. And the kids would run after balls, catch the balls for us. And one day we went down there, and there was a small crowd of people at the edge of the lake watching out in the lake as a boat seemed to be fishing around for something, a rowboat with a couple of people in it. And we asked what had happened and what was going on there, and it turns out that a young Burmese had had a fight with his wife, and in a fit of fury had swum out into the middle of the lake and gotten exhausted and not made it back. And so they were dredging for his body. And at about that moment, we saw them lift something into the boat. And so I took the kids and went up the stairs. And actually, I went up a long way because I figured they would come the stairs. And was just coming towards our little house when these two men carrying this body of this man who had drowned came running along past us, right past us. And the thing that struck me so strongly was that it was very clear that this man had not wanted to die. He was frozen in his last gasp. There's no other way to express it. His hands, his arms were flung back and up as if he was struggling to stay alive. Even though I slept for the next week with the lights on, because the intensity of that sight, because this man had not gone forward from this life. He was still caught in his body, even though it was no longer functioning, struggling still. It still didn't give me that much of a sense of my own mortality. It's only when we get older, usually, we get closer to a time when it really, really, really might happen or a really, really might happen, not just out of an accident, but we might have a heart attack or a stroke, or simply the body might give out. But when we're younger, we don't think of these things as much. Yet at the same time, the urgency is there. I remember a friend of mine who was about 10 years younger than I was asking to meet me for lunch. She was wanting to know some things about marriage as she was contemplating marrying her boyfriend who was 10 years younger than she was. Apparently they had quite a wonderful relationship, and we're talking about making it as permanent as things can be in this world. And it wasn't but a few months later that I happened to be in Sachin at Rochester, walking past the telephone at the reception desk at the center, and I was a monitor at that time. So on an intuition, I picked up the telephone, and it was my friend telling me that she'd just been diagnosed with stomach cancer, and she was going to see the oncologist. This was a Friday. She was going to see the oncologist on Monday to determine what could be done. She was 35 years old at the time. A few months later, she was dead. When I mentioned this to my brother, because at the time Cindy was the youngest person in the world, actually, to have died of stomach cancer. And my brother, the doctor, said, "Well, she's not anymore. We had a 19-year-old die in our town of stomach cancer." I have a friend who was ill, with a great pain in his middle many years ago, and the pain just kept getting worse, and he went to the doctors and they couldn't find anything wrong. Then he tried Eastern medicine, had acupuncture and moxa and all the treatments that they could come up with, herbal stuff. And still he couldn't eat because of the pain. If he ate anything, and eventually if he even drank water, the pain was so intense, it was preventative. And so another friend found him simply waiting to die. Eventually, he did find a doctor who on a hunch, did an MRI of his middle, assuming there was something to do with an artery that was about to rupture. And it turned out that wasn't the case. It turned out that he had tumors in his pancreas, some of them 2 centimeters in size, which is a pretty big chunk. It's almost an inch in diameter. And so they decided to do a biopsy. But all this time, and this went on for months and months and months and months, he began to examine his life and consider what he would regret in dying. And there was only one thing. Of all the things he could have done with his life that he regretted, and that was not coming to awakening. That was the only thing that he regretted. It wasn't getting married, having kids, having a career, all the things that society tells us are important in a person's life, of value in a person's life, and there's no contradicting that. human beings are social creatures, and if it's for us to be in partnership, if our karma is such that that's the case, then that makes sense. But at the end of the life, whatever we do with our life, how will we meet it? Will there be regrets or not? Will there be fear or not? How will it be when the light of your eyes is falling? Will you be like the crab with its 7 arms and 8 legs struggling to get out of the boiling water? Or will you be like some of these Zen masters? Or like Kaplaroshi, whose attending doctor was beside him as he died and said he had never seen such a peaceful death. And this was a man who worked with dying patients. He happened also to be the doctor of my friend Cindy. What is it that these Zen masters can do? What is it that they know that makes a difference for them at the last moment? How is it that they can seamlessly move on without regret, without fear, without anguish? The same comprehension awaits us if we go deeply enough into our practice. Back to Kusansunim. As each day passes, your lifespan decreases by 1 day. And as each hour passes, it decreases by 1 hour. Just listen to this clock. With every tick, the second hand moves, pauses, and moves on again. This itself can immediately be taken as a Dharma lecture of the Buddha. Therefore, the Mara of transiency is propelling us toward death every moment. If you do not realize the truth of the unborn, then when the time of your death suddenly arrives, you will find yourself moaning in illness. Even though nobody wants to die, every one of us will inevitably perish. Is there anyone here among you whose body is not a potential corpse? If there is, then speak out. Furthermore, should we live solely for the benefit of this potential corpse? That one is a really big question. Should we live solely for the benefit of this potential corpse? Or is there a deeper reason why we took birth? When you are finally moaning in illness, then you may have regrets at not having diligently practiced while alive, but at that time, such regrets will be in vain. Therefore, why do you not practice now? Why do you just continue to play around? The mind is just like the moon rising behind a mass of clouds, and those clouds are our distractions, our conditioning, our assumptions, our misperceptions. It seems dim because its brightness, like the brightness of the moon, is obscured and cannot shine forth. However, if the mind is purified, a Buddha will appear. People will say that from the day you awakened, a Buddha appeared in the world anew. But in reality, no Buddha ever came. Originally, the mind is there, bright and illuminating. And so this practice is really about uncovering this pure mind of awareness with which we are all endowed. Each time we extend that out breath far enough that we let everything else go, we move towards that experience of that pure mind of awareness. Originally, the mind is there, bright and illuminating. It does not become bright for the first time only when you awaken. When the mind is sullied, an ordinary person appears. Then people say that a Buddha has departed and that the world has become that of sentient beings. But in reality, a Buddha never departed. Therefore, a Buddha does not appear upon purification of the mind and likewise does not depart when the mind becomes sullied. Be careful not to fall into either of these two extremes. And yet, we hold dear this self-image. And it's usually a self-image of insufficiency. We got the impression somehow growing up that we don't matter, or that we're a failure, or that we're not worthy. These are all ideas. They're all inaccurate conclusions we've drawn about ourselves as children. They are not the truth. The truth we can find at the end of that out-breath, if we go far enough, long enough, with enough dedication and commitment. And, as it says in the Bible, the truth shall set you free. Does that in Zen too. Keep your wado bright and do not let it darken. That is that sense of questioning, whether it's the question of a koan, who am I? What is my face before my parents were born? What is that mu? What is the sound of one hand? Or that yearning that you use to drive the breath? The yearning, the need to know that you reach through the breath to find that answer. Keep it going, he says. Keep it going. Do not let it darken. Everything else can be left aside, but the Wado should be considered as your own life. You must try to investigate it like an old mouse entering a cow horn. In some countries, when people want to catch a mouse, they will put some fragrant oil in the pointed end of the horn, place it near the mouse's hole. The mouse is attracted by the smell and once it thinks it's safe, crawls into the horn. It gets nearer and nearer to the oil until finally its body gets stuck in the pointed end and it's unable to withdraw. In order to taste the oil, the foolish mouse has no fear of death and without any hesitation crawls right to the end of the horn. When even a mouse can be as brave as this in order to get what it desires, shouldn't human beings put forth a similar determination of mind in order to resolve the great matter of birth and death and to realize the great truth of the universe? Shouldn't human beings cease to be preoccupied with this body and one time exert themselves in order to awaken? You should practice with the same urgency as a person with a parched throat thinking of water. When you are very thirsty during a long walk in the mountains, for example, you may feel that you're about to choke from thirst and die unless you can soon drink some water. At such a time, you only think of water. Now, if you were to dig a well to find some, you would probably die before being able to reach any source of water. Therefore, you look earnestly all around you for water until you find some. In order to resolve the great matter of birth and death, you must practice with the same lack of preoccupation with the body as the mouse entering a cow horn, and with the same urgency and earnestness as a thirsty person searching for water. If you practice like this for some time, you will reach a point where the mind has nowhere left to go. It will feel, as the description in Zen goes, as if you're trying to climb a mountain of glass. There's nowhere you can get a handhold. There's nowhere you can get a foothold. Or a mountain of silver, same problem. Or like your mosquito trying to bite into an iron ball. It feels like you can't go forward and yet you can't go backwards. You've come all this way. What to do? Persist. Keep trying. Keep trying. Even if it feels hopeless, even if it feels impossible, keep digging at it. Keep working. Keep bringing that breath far out, so far out that you disappear in the process. And when you disappear completely, only then and your answer await you. If you practice like this for some time, you will reach a point where the mind has nowhere left to go. At that moment, thoughts are absent and all delusive thinking comes to a complete halt. At such a time, the mass of questioning alone appears brilliantly before your eyes. Now your practice may actually seem easy, but you should be most careful since this is a very crucial moment. You must hold on to the Wado with the same degree of energy as you would have upon meeting an enemy after 10,000 years and being resolute on taking revenge. Throughout beginningless eons, you have been transmigrating through the suffering ocean of birth and death. Now, for one time, a mass of questioning is clear and awakening is very close by. It is though it were screened off by a single sheet of white paper. Soon the moment will arrive when you can take revenge on birth and death through achieving liberation from them. In order to avenge yourself of such an enemy who has tormented you for so long, shouldn't you exert yourself to the utmost? You must be determined to pass over this crucial step. Otherwise, if you let it go by, the Wado will gradually lose its vividness, and it will be even harder to reach such a state again. Therefore, do not waste this opportunity. At this time, you will automatically forget to even sleep or eat. To not let this opportunity slip by requires true wisdom, so do not waste it. Be as resolute as the Buddha when he sat for 7 days uninterruptedly. The Buddha left home 41 eons after Maitreya Buddha, but because he sat beneath the Buddha tree for 7 days uninterruptedly, he was the first to realize Buddhahood. In the same manner, you must practice hard and diligently, being unconcerned whether you live or die. Then finally, a great awakening will be near. And another poem. Having transcended all intellection and perception, not even the slightest trace of any hindrance will remain. Your ocean-like chest will extend to the limits of space. The four walls will crumble, and the Buddhas of three times will not be seen anywhere. The three times are the past, present, and future. Without taking even a single step, you will ascend to the lotus realm. To transcend intellection means to no longer follow the impulses of conceptual consciousness. In addition, you must transcend all perceptions such as seeing, hearing, and mental cognition. When you undergo such experiences, it is a sign that your practice is developing well. But if you only try to reason and conceptualize intellectually while practicing, then you're merely indulging in childish games. For such an approach, it involves only delusive thinking. When nothing remains to contain the mind, then the four elements disappear and reveal a vast and boundless space. At this time, the pure original face will appear. Upon awakening, you become one with the Buddha and therefore cannot see the Buddha. You do not have to come or go anywhere. Right where you are is the very Buddha world. Even though you yourself are actually a Buddha living in a Buddha world, you do not realize this because your mind is obscured. Just awaken to the fact that you are a Buddha, and this world will be revealed just as it is, that is, as a Buddha world. There is no gain and no loss, no Buddha and no sentient beings. All is equal. All is a Buddha world, and all sentient beings, just as they are all Buddhas. For this reason, the Buddha said in the Diamond Sutra, "The Dharma I preach is no Dharma. Even though I speak, nothing is being said." Thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.